Welcome to Atlanta where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day. Big beats hit streets, see gangsters roaming, and parties don't stop till 8 in the morning.
Welcome to Atlanta where the players play, and we ride on them things like every day. Big beats hit streets, see gangsters roaming, and parties don't stop till 8 in the morning.
Now the party don't start till I walk in, and I usually don't leave.
Alright, hello, welcome to the first of season 2 of the 3NR podcast. We're podcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. This is Scott Phillips, and I'm joined by
Maggie Berkham
and Bill Batterman
and Roy Lefkowitz.
So the first thing I guess we're going to talk about is reactions from the Green Hill tournament. So the first thing I guess that I kind of noticed at this tournament is that it seemed like there was actually a lot of debates about the topic, at least that I was judging. The politics dissent didn't really have the preeminence that it once did. I think that might be because people are too lazy to cut updates on the midterm election DA. But what did you think, Bill? How was your view on what was being debated about the topic? What were the top issues?
I thought it was mostly about the topic, but I was a little bit disappointed that most of the affirmatives were very reliant on camp evidence. There was a lot of evidence from May and June, especially in the debates about Afghanistan, which was a little bit disappointing. I was a little bit surprised at how many teams were reading Japan affirmatives and Korea affirmatives. I thought there would be a lot more Afghanistan affirmatives. And I thought that there would be more people that would have cut updated Iraq affirmatives. But it seemed like more people were kind of racing to Japan and South Korea. But
I mean, are we on the same page that that's just because nothing changes there, so you don't have to cut any updates?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there are definitely updates to be had there. A lot is going on with North Korea and with China, and there's the internal Japanese politics stuff that can be updated. But I think a lot of people are probably betting on negatives not being super prepared with recent evidence, and so the threshold for how much they have to cut is probably a little bit lower. But especially at the round robin, it seemed like a lot of those teams had sort of run away from Afghanistan, which was a little bit surprising.
Well, Afghanistan is scary to prepare for, I think.
It is. The negative strategies I didn't think were particularly innovative, though. It seemed like a lot of people were going for politics and an advantage counterplanning against Afghanistan. There were some withdrawal disads, but a lot of that was just kind of generic withdrawal arguments from 2009 and early 2010. So I don't think there was really the high-tech negative arguments that I thought maybe there would be. But it'll be interesting to see if that changes at St. Mark's or Michigan as we get further into the year. But it seems like there are very few viable affirmatives, and so there's not really any reason why people shouldn't be able to keep up, especially with Afghanistan. Roy, what did you think about affirmative case selection at Green Hill?
Well, I think that as usual, we guess wrong. We thought that it was going to be Afghanistan-based, just like you were talking about. The Japan stuff was a little bit surprising, because I guess at Michigan it was popular in the lab that Scott taught and one of the classic labs, but it wasn't as preeminent amongst the older kids who were, you know, some of the better kids there. So I think that seeing some of the bigger teams read that was a little bit surprising, but South Korea doesn't take that much work to update, so people were going to do that. It'll be interesting to see if people chose those apps to see where other people went for Green Hill, and then we'll adapt based on that, because it looked like some of those apps were really just very stuck, the same 1ACs that were produced at camps without very much change or innovation. So,
Maggie, how popular was Japan and Korea in comparison to Afghanistan at DDI?
I would say that, at least compared to what I've seen from other places, Japan was more popular at DDI than other camps, and South Korea perhaps a little less popular. I think only a couple of the teams that cleared read South Korea, whereas a large number of the better teams, at least over the course of the camp, switched to reading Japan. So I guess I was perhaps not as surprised by the number of Japan apps, but was similarly surprised by the sort of overall lack of diversity in the affirmatives. I was expecting to see more affirmatives that relied on mechanisms or other advantage areas that had not been particularly explored at camp, expecting to be forced to rely more on generic arguments there. And there was frankly not a lot of new affirmative area, especially in terms of specificity.
Scott, what do you think about sort of subset apps? Do you think topicality substantially is viable against apps that withdraw like just a certain missile or just a certain carrier or something from Japan or whatever?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I think that a lot of these kind of smaller apps, it seems like their like dumb trick is to say they're police presence, not military presence, and then they're like, there's not very much police, so pulling out like five dudes who spray poppy fields with Roundup is therefore a substantial withdrawal. And it didn't seem, at least, I don't know, maybe it's just that like in the prelims I didn't judge a lot of kind of like teams that cleared because they had MPJ. So I was judging a lot of like, I did judge a lot of non-Afghanistan, Japan, Korea, I think, just because a lot of the teams who maybe were more in the like 3-3, 2-4 kind of thing, where I did think reading a lot of different apps. But it seemed in all of those debates that the NAG read T substantially in the 1NC, and then the AF had like some kind of trick, and then the NAG was just like, oh crap, and then lost. So I definitely think you should be going for that, but I think you need to think it through a little bit more than just like withdraws 50%, which seemed to be, you know, the major camp definition that people were at. And actually, at Chattahoochee this weekend, I judged a team who said it was like 25%, and they had like 6 to 12 cards from various military, like, handbooks and all kinds of other stuff about why, not in the context of withdrawal, all of them necessarily, but why just in general, if you're in the military, I guess, and somebody says substantial, you're thinking 25%. They also, though, ran into the problem of they didn't have any evidence establishing the baseline of, like, what was there. So winning that, the app was not 25%. They hadn't really thought that part through kind of fully. But I don't know. I think these small apps, you just have to go for T substantially, even though it, like, sucks. I mean, what else are you going to say? There's not really, you know, you're not going to have specific disad links. One thing I will say, though, is that, like, the benefit of having these small apps is, like, creating a prep disparity where, like, the app is really prepared. So the NAG reads like politics, and you have all kinds of like six specific link turns. And it doesn't seem like the AF is doing that in these debates that I judge. So you might not actually have to go for T substantially just because the AF blows, but that theoretically should be what the AF is doing. A lot of these small apps that are just like K apps that are just going to critique your disad anyway, so T substantially is not as relevant there. I don't know, Roy, you're a substantial expert. What do you think about the viability of this on the NAG versus small affirmatives?
Yeah, moving on. I didn't see a lot of these small apps. I saw the Big Stick South Korea app, so I didn't see how. I think I judged South Korea twice, and I don't really remember what the third one app was about. It's so long ago. So I haven't seen the way these substantial debates play out, but it seems as if the negative is not ready to have what the baseline is or be ready for the trick, then just saying it alone is not going to get the job done. Unless you read a Bears app, in which case it'll get the job done.
Is that an inside joke, Ray?
No.
Okay. Speaking of topicality, it seems like combat troops aren't presence is not winning any debates. I haven't even seen it extended in the NAG block. Have you seen it in the NAG block? One of the tricks that I guess the affirmative started saying is this police thing that Scott mentioned that their F also is police presence, and so it's still topical. Do you, any of you think that combat troops not topical is going to win any debates?
Any debates is a pretty low standard. I'm sure somewhere there's someone who... But win major debates.
Win debates between two competitive teams.
Okay, no. I guess I'll say no. I think that that's an argument that, especially given the way some of the affirmative choices have gone down, is a hard argument to win that sets any type of reasonable limit on the topic. I think that given sort of the ground that the AF has staked out and the very small number of affirmatives that are actually being debated, it would be very hard to persuade me, at least, that this is an area that really needs controlling for the negative. I think that there's a substantial difference here
25%?
Yeah, between this and T-Substantial, which is that... Yeah, terrible. Is
you
which is
the audition for this future podcast.
The T-Substantial debate has at least a variety of affirmatives that people would read that it's limiting out, and those affirmatives do somewhat seem difficult to debate, whereas it seems like the things that are limited out by combat troops are not only what has the core of what remains of the topic, but also sort of where people, the negative has the most ground.
It's not winnable.
It's what?
Not winnable.
Okay.
I think it's more winnable than social services or social workers. And that's certainly
one.
And
debates, yeah.
No, it's less winnable than that. But what about this, the weapon systems apps? Then they say that they withdraw the people who man those weapons? Or persons who...
You mean like when the plan is like remove gravity bombs and then in the 2AC they're like, oh... Of course, that means also we withdraw the troops.
Yeah, it also means we withdraw the gravity bomb operators.
The troops who would deal with that are the BMD systems, and they withdraw the people who like control the BMD.
Unless the plan says and people, that's a total non-starter.
The plan says just people. It seems like if they win, even if the plan includes people, if the weapon system is not topical, it's not particularly relevant.
This, you know, segues nicely into something that we wanted to talk about, which is plans that don't really say anything.
So all of them.
By not say anything, you mean what?
I mean plans that say something like the United States federal government should reduce its presence in Japan, or the United States federal government should reduce its military presence in Afghanistan, or its counterinsurgency presence in Afghanistan, or something like that. You know, 7 or 8 words that then becomes different things based on what the 1NC says. We've talked about it before, but Scott, what do you think about that? What can the negative do when the AF doesn't really say what their plan does?
Well, I mean, back in the day, like, when I debated, there was always, like, some kind of strategic cost. I remember, like, GBN used to put in their plan, like, all or nearly all the time. And then it would, like, list things that they wanted to do. And then finally, like, I think Edgemont beat them on the, like, exclude nearly all and just do all. And they had, like, all these court definitions of why, like, including nearly all in legislation was bad or something. And it seems like nowadays that kind of stuff just, like, wouldn't fly. So, like, these vague plans should theoretically open them up to some kind of, like, pick, but people just let them get away with kind of permuting out of all of those, I think. So it's like there's not really a good negative recourse other than, like, vagueness when the AF has a pretty ridiculous plan like that. So in general, I think it kind of, like, pretty much hoses the NAG. I mean, I guess the reason they're doing it is to get out of, like, more specific picks about, I guess, not withdrawing certain kinds of troops or something. But I don't know. I don't really see... I mean, I guess I heard at Greenhill that someone read a, like, not withdraw embassy guards pick. That was kind of cool, but other than that, it doesn't really seem like people are reading those strategies, so it doesn't seem like there's a huge necessity or a lot of good AF arguments for why they need a plan, that's kind of vague and ridiculous.
Yeah, at camp, at SDI, there was a pick written against the Futenma AF that just maintained the Jungle Warfare Training Center, but withdrew
it's
the
kind of racist.
And... That was actually one of the F arguments that I got, but the Jungle Warfare Training Center is like a subcomponent of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force, and so the counterplan would withdraw that, and so it seems like the Futenma affirmatives are now either, like, I think Damien, like, lists out different parts of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Force that's not that, other ones just say nearly all.
See, I think the Damien list them out legit.
Yeah,
nearly all ridiculous.
Ridiculous, I agree. I kind of fought the good fight with some people at camp about vagueness as a voting issue, and it seems like it's utterly unwinnable in front of a big subset of judges. If you have a judge that will not vote on vagueness, what do you do when the AF kind of wishes away your strategy with?
Don't prep them next time. Jokers.
Well, if it's a large majority,
it seems like it's a majority.
You can't just not prep a large
especially,
majority.
It seems
you
like
have to prep someone.
Don't prep them.
It seems like the college people, and I guess, Scott, you're now a college first person, but it seems like the college people are much, much less willing to vote on that. At least the people that are sort of MSU slash Whitman affiliated, slash Kansas, that were made up most of the staff at SDI. Their argument was that as long as you're topical, it doesn't matter if you're vague. What do you think the sort of what alternative do you have other than vagueness? Is there anything?
Well, I mean, anytime someone tells me, like, X judge won't vote on Y, first of all, it's like if you just roll in and just rock someone on vagueness and you have cards about why we should be specific and cards about why being vague is bad, they're going to vote on it. Let's just throw that out there. Like, people who are like, X won't vote on Y, it's because some random team stunk, and then they're like, oh my God, we can never win on this. It's like people used to always tell me, these people won't vote on A-spec. And let me tell you, it's like Oprah says, nobody discriminates against excellence. So if you just trounce someone on A-spec, you're getting the ballot. And similarly...
Hold on, you just said, like Oprah says, right? Just checking. You watch Oprah?
I get them in the book club.
Okay.
But so, first of all, I think if you actually did some legwork on vagueness, as opposed to, like, generally it's like, I think at Georgia State I heard a 1NC vagueness shell that was less than 4 seconds. And so in that instance, you are probably right that the majority of judges are not going to vote on vagueness. But, like, I noticed the much-improved Woodward Wiki this year that you have, in fact, cut some evidence about why being vague about proposals for withdrawing Afghanistan is not a good idea. I think if you presented, you know, one of these whatever judges you think from the SDI wouldn't vote on it with some proof that you're not just like a lazy D-bag, but in fact you prepared for the topic and the AF is actually dodging, you know, a substantive debate, that they'd be much more likely to vote on it. But let's assume that they'll never vote on it. Mm-hmm. I mean, the K, obviously.
The K,
right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what recourse do you have if they're going to shift out of all of your substantive arguments? Can't shift out of using the state.
I just don't understand how people are like, the AF does not need to specify anything, and then when the negative says something in the 1NC that's like related to the AF, the AF is like, oh, that's not us. Well, how do you, in what world is that reasonable for the AF to get to spike out of all of that, or, you know, counterinsurgency bad arguments or stuff? How do they get to not, how do they get to wish it away? When, at what point did we decide it was okay for that to happen?
I honestly just think that, like,
if your plan is less than 8 words or less than 12 words, it probably doesn't do anything.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think solvency against some of these apps that are, like, remove substantial counterinsurgency, like, just read the card, substantial is 25%. Say the plan removes 25% of counterinsurgency.
But
they don't
not
solve
our
any
that's
of
not
their
our
advantages.
That's not us. That's not what we do.
Well, they have to read a counterinterpretation of substantially that says it's more than
we're
that.
Yeah, we get to choose. We don't have to defend this.
Yeah, that's actually, have you ever seen anybody do that?
No, it would be smart. Why would someone do that?
Because, if you say that, you say substantials, I mean, there's cards that it's like 10%. Say it's 10%. That means that the AF only reduces 10% of counterinsurgency operations. Say that's not nearly enough to solve your case. 2AC says counterinterpretation substantially means 90%. We do 90%. Then you just have your dissent link.
Also, what is a phase withdrawal?
I mean,
withdrawals in phases.
Yeah, which phases? If we read a DA about this phase, you're probably not that phase, I'm guessing.
Well, this was like, at least in the like discussions at Michigan where I heard, you know, the brain trust discussing
the meeting of the minds.
They were kind of basically like, they thought that this kind of mooted the competition for condition counterplans because they thought that putting phased in the plan gave you kind of grounds for saying the plan was not immediate, basically.
That makes no sense to me, and we have phased in our plan.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense to me either.
We don't have phase in our plan.
Because the plan happens immediately in either case.
The withdrawal.
Just the withdrawal happens. Yeah.
Well, the counterplan doesn't condition the passage of legislation. It conditions the withdrawal, which does not happen immediately. I'm not saying that
they're right.
That would be their boneheaded
wrong
response.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's moronic as well.
I mean, it makes sense.
Don't give it credit.
I'm not saying that makes sense. I'm saying it makes sense to interpret withdrawal not to be immediate, which is something that the negative, when they're going for these like withdrawal dissents, says that's just totally stupid, that like, tomorrow there will be no more troops in Afghanistan and that would be bad. But I'm not sure. I mean, it's just any withdrawal would be a phased withdrawal. You don't just immediately withdraw.
You couldn't withdraw everyone physically at one point.
I mean, logistically,
how do they all get out? There's not enough C-130s. They'd have to do two trips. And it's more.
They have to do more than two trips.
You know what I mean? There's obviously more than what, it's not going everyone at one point. Just cross over the border all at once. Just stampede through. People are such idiots.
Yeah, it's the negative's fault because the negative cheats, but now the affirmative has, in an attempt to avoid the negative's cheating, has.
I almost think the negative has to cheat now because the app is cheating back.
Yeah.
Well, I don't even think it's the negative's fault. I think it's the like judges who are so nag-leaning on reasonable AF theory arguments, they have made it such that the AF doesn't really have a recourse against some of these counterplans other than to make their plan incoherent.
Nothing.
And that's just because they're either like reject argument, not team, so they AF can't, you know, dedicate time to theory strategically, or they're just like, you dropped conditionality, but I don't think it's a voted issue.
Yeah, the counterplan goes away.
The counterplan goes away. I'm just going to evaluate the status quo versus the DA versus the plan, and I'm obviously going to think that the DA turns the case, and so I voted negative.
The people who do think that, though, they really think we're unreasonable.
Yeah.
They look at us...
Not unreasonable, illogical. They're not a logical policymaker.
They look at us like we are on the crazy pills. Like, I don't know what happened, but when I'm like, it's a voting issue, they're like, what? What do you mean it's a voting issue? It just goes away. In what world does that make sense? I don't get it. How do I look like a... I mean, I might be a crazy person in general, but in this instance... I feel like I'm being perfectly reasonable, and I get looked at by people who are like, you're crazy, it's never a voting issue. The negative should never lose for doing anything.
Well, I just think that the people who, I guess, think it's beyond debatable, like, people who write in their judge philosophy, I will apply, reject argument, not team, even if said.
Who says that?
No,
a lot of people.
Like, any wake along.
I would say at least 25%.
The last 10 years.
Well, Jared's reasonable about it, at least. Maybe it'll change there.
Conditionality is reasonable.
Yeah.
I don't know if you'll have much luck on agent counterplans.
Yeah, conditioning.
Unless you make the argument that a rational policymaker doesn't control both agents.
Both agents.
Then they're out. They're like, oh, yeah, that's logical again, so that's good.
Oh, God.
One of the core negative arguments is the deterrence disadvantage / the resolve disadvantage or credibility, and that's probably going to continue to be a big argument throughout the season. There are sort of specific variants of this argument that apply to the different portions of the topic. So there is a deterrence disadvantage about Japan and South Korea. There's a deterrence disadvantage about withdrawal from Afghanistan. One thing that we talked about before the show was the necessity of the affirmative reading some theoretical defenses or sort of indictments of the deterrence disad and the theory of deterrence. This is something that I found myself mentioning in a couple of post rounds. But Scott, why don't you sort of explain what we're talking about and what we mean by the need for some theoretical indictments of the deterrence disad?
Well, basically, I guess there's kind of two main points. One is that the kind of substantive affirmative answers to the deterrence disad are not very nuanced. They're just kind of like, nope, doesn't hurt deterrence, and, you know, they may have, like, some good rhetoric, but that's about it. And second, the negative link evidence is just crazy, you know, the kind of, like, Kagan and Kagan-style Afghanistan withdrawal link card is much better than, at least rhetorically, than most of the affirmative answers. And so the nag, I think, in all these deterrence debates is largely winning because of this kind of, like, asymmetric evidence superiority. And so I think the affirmative kind of needs to respond by pushing the debate into kind of, like, a more academic realm where people like Kagan and Crystal and Wolferth and, you know, those kind of people aren't necessarily as credible. And so I think, you know, kind of two ways that you can do that. One kind of probably more moderate and a little more radical is, like, first, there's just a lot of kind of, you know, statistical and social science data about deterrence logic and whether or not it's effective. And so I remember, like, when we ran the CTBT in college, there's, like, a Keith Payne article about nuclear deterrence. And kind of why the majority of Cold War assumptions about how deterrence works are not statistically borne out by, you know, kind of historical events and whatnot. And so when people would read their crazy Heritage Foundation deterrence links, you know, you read this, and it's difficult for them to say, you know, well, the Heritage Foundation is as academically rigorous because they don't really present evidence in the same manner as kind of peer-reviewed social science journals. So if you kind of find that evidence, I think that would help you counter the kind of like rhetorical craziness, and it kind of supports the like Tim Algeretti style argument of like the more crazy the evidence is, the worse it is, not the better, because it kind of shows the author as like a deranged lunatic. And then second, I mean, just reading some kind of like critique evidence, even if you have a substantive AF, that just indicts deterrence logic. So there's like a million books in the context of the Iraq War that critique the like cut and run or credibility rhetoric, and just kind of say that it, you know, it's like a justification for kind of like the military industrial complex to make more money. And so it's like, you know, some teams are like, oh, well, we read a hegemony advantage, we can't really read that. And it's like, well, different people think hegemony is good for different reasons, and not everyone who thinks hegemony is good buys into the cut and run critique of U.S. withdrawal. And so I think reading evidence like that and almost making an epistemology kind of argument about where the negative evidence is coming from and kind of who's writing it and why, you know, that is important is much better than reading 10 additional cards like withdrawal from Afghanistan doesn't hurt credibility, no warrant, really, no explanation, no crazy rhetoric.
Yeah, that's actually something else that is probably worth talking about. I think... I don't know if it's strange that other people are not noticing this slash having an issue with this, but a lot of affirmatives are withdrawing from one of the topic countries, reading a bunch of evidence from the Cato Institute, from the sort of libertarian offshore balancers, from Christopher Lane, and then the terminal impact to their advantage is evidence from Robert Kagan or from Bradley Thayer. And it just doesn't make any sense to me that the negative doesn't just read links to hegemony from Kagan and say that the terminal impact that the affirmative read assumes the internal link that the negative just read about credibility or resolve or whatever, not the like imperial overstretch argument that the affirmative read. Do you think that's a winning argument? I guess I don't understand why people just kind of let that fly, that like, the AF is primacy bad, we need to offshore balance, and the impact is primacy good.
Well, I just think in general you should never read any evidence from like Kagan or Thayer. I mean, there are better cards from more qualified people who don't have like a million indicts and like specific critique links about the things they write. But in general, yeah, I did like, I mean, that was every Afghanistan debate this summer, is the AF was like, withdraw, impact Kagan, and then the neg would be like, withdraw, disad. All three Kagans don't think that we should withdraw. And so it seems like the AFs are reading, not. I don't even think of those as hegemony impacts. They're like intervention good impacts. Yeah. They're like reasons the U.S. should be like Globocop.
Yeah, should be in Afghanistan.
Which is the opposite of what the AF
like,
is saying.
In order to be in Afghanistan, we should do our plan, which withdraws from Afghanistan.
Sorry, go ahead.
Well, mine is a little bit tangentially related, so you can go
ahead. Oh, well, just real quick, I just think that like, that's why Khalilzad, I think, is still one of the best hegemony impact cards, not the like short one sentence nuclear exchange, but the like bigger one that talks about all the regions, because it's about like security commitments and not about intervention, which is a distinction that most of the neocon evidence, like I don't even think they would know that that's a distinction made in the hegemony literature, but it's not about why we should be like constantly rolling around messing people up. It's about why we should just have like project force, not, or project strength, not use force.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that brought up was that, especially with these AFs, that I guess the two things were that, first, people seem to be making the deterrence DA just like a big hodgepodge DA that's like an ally prolif DA plus deterrence plus this, which I think 2ACs need to be wary about, because the negative is like, you consider the ally prolif part of this DA, it's different than deterrence.
Yeah, but like St. Mark's, 6 DA and 1.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it's really different or that it is, but at least you need to be on top of that, but the other thing is that the terminal impacts of the DA and the AF seem to be the same, and it seems as if the AF seems to have trouble, or at least as a judge sometimes it's tough to figure out, if it's not debated well by the two teams, if the terminal impact is conflict, you know, Asian conflict or Korean War, who accesses it? Does the deterrence DA access it? Does the AF access it? The same thing with Afghanistan debates about, like, a stability DA with an AF that claims, like, a stability advantage. It seems like there needs to be better discussion by both teams about, you know, overall ability to solve for those impacts, who solves for them faster, why the way in which they access that impact before, the way they access the impact is more important than the way in which the other team accesses their impact, because a lot of those debates seem to be getting pretty sloppy.
I think I think part of that is, and this, I don't mean this unkindly, but those debates are hard to have. And they're harder than, you know, I have my state's counterplan and my politics DA that, you know, solves your case and the politics DA accesses an external impact. I think that one of the things that I saw at Greenhill that was great is that every team is debating the case, and you have to debate the case in order to access any of the negative arguments. Because, to be honest, lots of these dissads are really, we turn your case. That said, that creates a lot of problems for the teams in the middle that have in the past been able to get by on having a specific strategy that they're pretty good at and not having to interact very much with what the AF said. And I think that this is sort of a first semester defining time for those teams to try and figure out, are they going to be able to make those distinctions that make the difference in the good debates. I think that some of the debates that I saw, the difference between, you know, a team that didn't clear or almost cleared and a team that went deep into the elims seemed much greater than it has in the past, just because the level of analysis got ratcheted up so much more and the distinctions that they had to make were so much greater.
Yeah, and I think that kind of what Maggie said about the template of, like, dissad and state's counterplan is, like, people still haven't changed the way they do impact calculus. And so I judged maybe 3 or 4 Korea debates where the whole 2NC overview and then the 2NR overview was, like, the magnitude of Korean conflict outweighs. And then the 2AR was like, no, our Korea conflict is bigger. And it's like, you have the same impact card. So you need to be talking about probability, not kind of terminal impact. And so teams aren't really shifting to that and are instead just being like, oh, my God, send our Africa Times card, Korea conflict causes extinction. And so I don't think people really realize that the NAG, when they're, you know, link-turning your case, it's just like if they link-turn the politics DA. It's not as important to spend as much time on the impact overview. But kind of second, you know, I think that the way a lot of these Korea affirmatives are written is to have 8 advantages that are 3 cards apiece. Which I never really had a term to refer to, but I'm now told is the run-and-gun affirmative.
Who'd you get that from?
I don't remember.
Galloway.
But, so, they don't have a very good 2AR, given the way their 1AC is written, because the 2AR should be, you know, we have the best internal link into Korean conflict, we have the most qualified evidence, we're controlling uniqueness. But it's like, they don't even read uniqueness cards, A. They maybe read a card about that ship getting sunk. B, they have 1 internal link card that's, like, under-highlighted. And so then the NAG probably has more cards on all the important issues in the 1NC their deterrence disad than the AF had in their advantage, because they wanted to have 28 reasons why there'd be a war in Korea instead of 1 good one.
Yeah, nobody ever... The thing that I don't think debaters understand is that nobody ever votes on, I thought there was a 2% chance that there'd be a war for this reason, plus a 2% chance there'd be a war for this reason, plus blah, 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 blah. So eventually I decided that because of the super low risk of all of these, there's definitely a good chance there's going to be a war.
Yeah, they use the Kamal Ghali, like, 30% risk of 5 dissents, 150% rationale.
Like, I don't understand. And it's the same thing with the AFs when they go for kind of multiple advantages but don't really win any of them. It's the same with the negative when they go for... just sort of multiple link turns, like the withdrawal dissent against Afghanistan. They've got a bunch of different arguments that are really just kind of impact assertions. They don't really just dig in on one and explain it.
Yeah, there's no such thing as a 2-card advantage. Yeah. There's a 2-card add-on.
There's a 2-card add-on.
That's good. Yeah. But an advantage should not be less than 3 minutes. If it's less than 3 minutes, you're wasting your time.
And the thing that bothers me about that, too, is that the negative is not smart enough to make them pay for having such short advantages by just kind of laundry listing the things that they have not demonstrated in the advantage and forcing the 2AC to either kick out of it even though the NAG didn't have anything or read cards about all those issues. If the NAG could, like, intelligently do that, you know, you don't have uniqueness for this claim, you don't have an internal link for this claim, you don't have an impact for this.
Yeah, instead what they do is they just read terminal impact defense.
Yes, that's
so they have to, like, 1-card terrorism advantage, and they're like,
terrorism is not a big
like,
deal.
And the AF's like, hey, I read a card on that. That's the card we read.
And then the 2AC just says, extend or 1AC evidence, and then moving on.
I mean, I guess it's harder to prepare, but I really feel like if teams, instead of having like 700-page impact defense files, which are like all the rage right now, if they just had like internal link defense files, that would be a lot better.
In a lot of these debates, really the overview should be internal link arguments and internal link comparisons, not impact comparisons, because if you're debating Afghanistan, kind of everyone can agree that the collapse of Afghanistan is bad in a lot of these debates. The question is just what is more likely to collapse Afghanistan? Is it maintaining coin, or is it transitioning to CT? Is it precipitous withdrawal, whatever?
Well, also, and I mean, one thing that, just based on what you said there, that a lot of teams don't understand is that the AF could result in stability in some parts of Afghanistan and instability in other parts of Afghanistan. And nobody ever really explains why, like, the terminal impact cards about why Afghan instability is bad assume kind of, like, countrywide chaos. And a lot of the, like, NAG credibility DA links are, like, 10-person villages in Afghanistan will be reclaimed by the Taliban. They're not really talking about the same things that the impact evidence is talking about.
Yeah, for sure. And the other thing that's strange is that a lot of the AF authors for Afghanistan in particular make the argument that Afghanistan instability is not a big deal, it's not going to be a terrorist haven, but affirmatives, instead of playing that defensive perspective, say the opposite and kind of read the NAG authors for the impact level of the argument, but read the AF authors to get there. So it's like, you know, evidence from Cato people that think that instability in Afghanistan is no big deal. They read those arguments, and then the impact is like Afghani instability causes nuclear war from a Heritage Foundation person. And I think, I don't understand why negatives, we sort of talked about that already, don't take more advantage of that. Because it seems like if the affirmative has already lent credibility to the Heritage Foundation and to that perspective about the importance of Afghanistan, the link evidence from the Heritage Foundation would be better for resolving that debate than the AF evidence from the Cato Institute.
I mean, can we all just agree that terrorism is the worst impact ever? I mean, internal link is always awful. The impact is overclaimed and ridiculous.
Yes.
No one solves it. No one affects it.
The idea that terrorism could cause extinction is just baffling to me.
It's almost as illogical as genocide causing extinction, yeah, which is, I think, my least favorite impact of all time.
We just stopped a Mumbai-style plot in Europe today, though, if you're paying attention to the news. That was a big... It could have caused some bad shit.
I don't think it would have caused extinction.
You don't know.
Yeah.
And that does kind of beg the question of, like, extinction fetishism and whatnot.
Yeah,
that's
right, extinction fetishism is totally stupid. Because terrorism is obviously bad, it's just not bad for the reason that debaters say it's bad.
And there's not a one-to-one causal relationship between, like, Afghanistan becoming a terrorist training ground and people dying in the U.S.
Hold on. Afghanistan is a terrorist training ground. Where the terrorists, they're there.
300 or less.
Back to the extinction.
You think there's only 300 terrorists in Afghanistan?
That's what the CIA thinks.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
The CIA thinks there's less than 300 Al-Qaeda.
I could go to Afghanistan tomorrow and find 300 terrorists.
Well, yeah, I mean, you need to understand Roy's, like, Zionist interpretation of what is a terrorist. Yeah,
there are more than 300
brown people. You think there are 300 terrorists only in Afghanistan?
Well, I don't have an opinion.
I think there are 300 terrorists a mile away from where we live in Atlanta. What do you mean there's 300 terrorists in the whole country of Afghanistan?
That's what the CIA says.
The CIA is lying to you. How many people are in Afghanistan?
Why don't you do research on that?
I'm about to
I guess
do
the
that
CIA
research.
Is operating under the tenuous assumption that not all people in Afghanistan are terrorists, Roy. You have pointed to the fatal flaw in their
not
statistical
report. Not all. 300?
Definitely go for the epistemology.
300 people in all of Afghanistan are terrorists? I'm sure they don't keep accurate records of how many people are in Afghanistan. Third world country and all. But there's got to be more than 300 of them, I bet you that.
All right, so moving right along.
That concludes the racist
the Orientalist portion of the podcast.
29 million people! 300 total terrorists!
So I guess one in a million is not a terrorist.
That is unbelievable. Its population has doubled since 1979, though.
And that concludes the Wikipedia portion of the program. One thing that that Maggie mentioned that I think I also agree with is that the middle sort of, I guess that's one way to put it, but the sort of developing debaters, the debaters not at the top echelon, the debaters that aren't competing for invitational championships, but the debaters who are just kind of playing the game, maybe they're pretty good, kind of good, average, the people that are, most of the people that go to debate tournaments are struggling more than I can remember, and one of the things that I think is causing them to struggle
paperless.
Is paperless, and some,
I didn't know that was actually the
some
answer.
Of the issues that are that kind of go along with that. The
where did the tubs go? Nobody has tubs anymore.
Yeah, nobody has tubs anymore. That's correct, right? There are now computers.
Less than 300 tubs a tournament.
Less than 300 tubs a tournament.
There are more more terrorists than tubs.
But one of the things that I guess we'll come back to some of the discussions of paperless, the mechanics of paperless, the norms surrounding paperless. But one thing that I think we all agree on, and that I think most people that judge high school debates agree on, is that whether it's a product of paperless or it's just, it just correlates with the rise of paperless, people have lost the ability or the desire to flow, and that
is
having
flowing?
Some very bad effects on the quality of debates, because while the top tier can kind of manage at least okay, even in a world where their flowing skills are not great, they can kind of make up for it to some extent. The people in the middle are really, really struggling when they don't have a flow of the debate, when they're not flowing their opponent's speeches, they're not listening, they're relying exclusively on reading the speech documents that have been flashed to them by their opponents. And they're kind of having their own little debate that is not verbalized at any point to the judge. And it's very frustrating. So, Roy, why don't you go on your little planned rant here about flowing?
I mean, nobody flows. They stand up, someone gives a speech, and I don't know what's going on. I mean, people make fun of me for not flowing as much as a judge. I flow 3 to 4 times as much as the average high school debater flows a debate. Someone stands up, they jump the other team the speech. These two jokers sit there for 8 minutes or 5 minutes, depending on the length of the speech, and just do nothing. I don't know what they're doing. They're looking. They might be playing spider solitaire, doing all these different things. No one pays attention. Then the cross-ex happens. You have to ask, which card did you read, which card didn't you read, which card didn't you read, which is 30 seconds or so or 2 minutes of the cross-ex. And then the 2E seal stand up and will start answering cards that were not in the 2EC itself. Which, if you're not going to flow, at least, here's a tip. If you choose that you don't care about what I say, which is fine, and you don't want to flow, at least ask the other team in the cross-ex which cards they read so that you waste less of your time not answering cards that were not there. I mean, all four of us judge at Greenhill. I'm guessing that in at least twice a debate, someone answered evidence that was not read in a speech because it was jumped to them, and since it was jumped to them, it had to have been read.
I judged a debate this summer where the 1NR spent 5 minutes answering a politics dissent that had been dropped by the 2AC.
No paying attention. Nobody listens. What are you so busy doing? Your debating is not so good that you can afford to not listen to what's going on. It's not like you're debating well and not answering stuff. You're sucking it up. I mean, you're horrible. If you don't flow, you are likely terrible at debate. And paperless is enabling all of these clowns because they can just get the speech jumped to them. The most basic thing in debate is you don't have to be good at debate. You might not be able to produce a coherent thought in your head, but at least be able to write down something. Right? That is the minimum standard. Write down what the other team says. Next, we'll get you good at answering it. But please, make an effort to write down what they're saying. And I don't know who it started with. Well, I guess we've heard rumors about who it started with. But people just think that they don't need to flow. They just walk around during the speeches. They start talking to their partner. I can't even hear the speaker going half the time because these two partners are in conversation about what's for dinner next because they're not listening. They're just doing do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do on their laptop. And I bet you also people cheat like crazy with this paperless stuff. I bet you people scroll through that like it's their job, which is another thing. I don't know, that's another paperless rant. But I know I would have cheated for sure. Like it's a and got through and looked at other people's speeches. So I assume that people have less moral scruples than I do.
Well, here's one dumb thing about that is that I see these paperless teams, when they set up their viewing computers, they leave the document map open.
You just look at
so
it.
You don't have to scroll. The name of every 1AC argument is conveniently listed for
you. Why wouldn't they be reading from full screen?
No, on the viewing computer.
Oh. Yeah, that's stupid too. But people clearly cheat. I see people like going like this, like there's been 2 cards read.
It's radio, Roy. They can't see the gesture that you're doing.
This radio. The fire. I see people doing this. Like mad people during speeches. They're not looking at this one piece of evidence that's there. So yeah, I think I'm going to reward people. Actually, Aldretti said this. Did you guys talk to him about this? At Greenhill, he was like, he wrote into his judge philosophy that if you show me your flow and that you flowed, he'll give you an extra half speaker point. I'm thinking about doing that. If you show me that you produced a good flow, and I look at you and you were noticeably writing stuff down that wasn't doodles during the debate, and you show me the flow before I sign the ballot or right after the debate, I'll give you half an extra speaker point, just in order to reward flowing. What do you all think about that? I think it's like, it might be bad because it's like giving people, you know, $20 for getting an A, but this is more like giving people $20 for not being completely stupid. But nonetheless, let's get the flowing trend. And if you don't flow, post onto this podcast why you don't flow and a coherent response as to why you don't flow debates. And tell me why you think it's true. And then I'll forget to write it down, so I'll drop it. But maybe, you know.
I think I need to start giving out more half points for random things like that, just because apparently everybody gets a 30 now. I didn't get that memo before Green Hill.
It's true.
I don't know if any of you saw the results back yet. I think people are just doing kind of Roy-esque things like, you gave a speech, 30 extra points, blah, blah, blah.
For the record, my mutual preference worked that out. One of our kids got a 30.
Well, it certainly wasn't from coaching. But, I mean, I think even more than just like, I mean, obviously the line-by-line is like the fundamental of debate. If you don't have that, then you're done. But also just like conceptually, I don't know how you figure out what arguments to go for, what arguments to extend, whether you're winning or losing without a flow. Like, how do you decide what arguments to extend in the 1&R without knowing what the negative said?
This is the other thing. I completely agree with you. And this is the other thing that's becoming epidemic-wise. It always happens with, like, the horrible kids, like the really bad debaters. But this is happening more often that during the 2AC, the 1A will be getting stuff ready for the 2AC. So by the time the 2AC sits down, they as an app team have zero idea of what was said in the 2AC. And they have none of them. Nobody has a flow. How do you expect to win debates? Use more prep time. Get the speech ready. Have your partner write stuff down so that you can reference it later. I've never seen a good 1AR go after not having a flow of the 2AC, and then the 2AC not having a flow of the 2AC. So you have to backflow, but in order to backflow, you have to flow. So if you're getting your speech ready for your partner, who's the 2A, they shouldn't be the 2A. Make them do double ones. If they can't get a 2AC ready on a topic with 6 apps, 5 DAs, and 10 case arguments, all right? You should have everything ready. There's nothing big about it. If they say critique, alt fails, permutation, moving on. Conditionality, too. That's all you need. If you say that, that's enough in front of most people. But there's no way you can win the debate on the app if you do not have a flow, if neither you nor your partner have a flow. One person flow, maybe. Two people, no flow, no win.
I think this also sort of ties pretty clearly into the sort of discussion we were having earlier about being able to make critical distinctions on the internal link level. You can probably get through the debate where you only have to do some impact analysis to win the debate without being able to flow. But by the time you get to complex arguments, not only do the arguments interrelate, which means that you have to pay attention to what the other team said about that relationship, but the arguments are more complicated and involve more nuance, which means that not having them written down or answering them in a different order may very greatly change the quality of the debate and your ability to actually win any of the arguments you're making, much less, you know, most of them.
Argument comparison? What is this you speak of?
Yeah,
they got to start comparing arguments, and then they can start comparing evidence, and then we'll have some debating. The thing that I don't understand, just from the perspective of a debater, is that it seems like if I was a debater, I would want to experience my opponent's speeches in the same way that the judge experiences them. I don't want to experience them in a different way. Well, maybe annoyed, but I would want to listen to what they're saying, listen to the arguments that they're putting more emphasis on, watch the judge's reaction to the arguments, and then kind of participate in the debate in the same way the judge is. If I'm just reading sort of a transcript of their speech, I don't know what arguments they're focusing on. I don't know where they're making connections. I don't know what sort of sounds persuasive to me, what sounds terrible to me, because I'm just looking at the text, the raw text, and that doesn't, in a lot of times,
what are they doing
communicate the
during
character.
That time?
I mean, I look at kids all the time, and they're just reading the other team's stuff, but I don't think that they're reading it for any reason.
Yeah, it would be really cool if they were reading it in order to make awesome, like, evidence comparisons about, you know, ununderlined parts of evidence / warrants that are included or not included, etc. But it does just sort of seem like it's reading the transcript in order to find out what was said, but not getting those arguments into the speech. And anyone that does sort of start doing that immediately raises the level of debate for everyone around them. I mean, there's a huge opportunity for someone who can actually flow and also, uses the effect that they have real-time access to the evidence to start actually making those evidence comparisons.
It's sad that we have to talk about in a podcast about debate for people who presumably are not just ninth graders, that they need to flow. And that we're talking about raising the level of debate by saying people who flow... And compare arguments.
To listen to what your opponent says, you have to think about it, and then you need to respond.
There are snakes on this plane, people. You all are stinking it up.
It's embedded clash, Coach. Embedded clash.
Well, the priorities, I mean, like, it's just what kids think are important. It's no longer the line-by-line and flowing and
evidence. It's getting the evidence jumped to you. That's the priority.
Terminal interest
comparison. I need this card right now.
Yeah, I made a note about that, but the article
you're
that
flowing
you just
this
wrote,
podcast.
I'm flowing this podcast so that I can speak intelligently about it.
Well, step one, flow. Step two,
we'll work on the intelligence part. But I would have no chance if I wasn't flowing. But the something that you mentioned in your article about 2AC responses to the case is that so many debaters, and this is certainly true of the 2AC and the affirmative in general, but it's also true, probably even more so in the negative. They're only debate is about how big something is and how bad it is. So there are debaters who, like, their best skill is to explain why a nuclear war with Russia would be really bad, or why extinction is, you know, really, really bad, or why global warming, you know, someday is going to kill everyone. And it's not, they're not really debating because no one's disagreeing with them. They're just emphasizing a part of the debate that's kind of conceded, and then they're just talking about it a lot, which is really annoying, and I don't know why that happens. Why don't you talk about the, for those that didn't read, / those that need a refresher, if warming is going to happen and it's going to cause extinction in 100 years, why does that not auto-win the affirmative of the debate? Because when I listen to 2ACs and 2ARs, they're telling me warming is going to cause extinction, you know, at some point, so the AF auto-wins, and I'm very persuaded by that, so help me out.
Well, I guess kind of two points that drive me up the wall. One is, like, try or die. Just fundamentally makes no sense to me. Maybe it's just my life experience, but I've kind of noticed that things can always get worse. Just when you think it's like no V2L, something comes around the corner and it's just like, oh, it's worse now. So a lot of times people will say, like, we control the uniqueness to the conflict in Afghanistan. No, you don't. It's like, things in Afghanistan, not perfect. Could they get worse? Clearly.
There's only 300 terrorists. There will be more.
There could be more than 300 terrorists post the plan. So anytime someone says try or die, my estimation of their, like, IQ level drops at least 20 points because it just doesn't make any sense to me. But the worst form of try or die to me is this kind of, like, terminal impact uniqueness. And I really don't know where that phrase came from. But if I had a time machine and was given the option to go back and, like, prevent an atrocity or kill whoever came up with this, you know, sorry, atrocity victims, but...
Nobody would testify against you.
I mean, it's just like the idea that when you go for an economy DA, that a terrorist attack would also hurt the economy means no risk of DA is ludicrous. And that's, I mean, I even when I vote the same way as people, when they give that rationale, it makes me feel terrible about my decision because it's just like I'm with stupid. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. But I see a lot of times, like, the other team will maybe, like, say time frame or something, but nobody ever gets really aggressive about it. And it's, like, the same way if you debated, you know, positive peace, and they were like, structural violence is the root cause of war, so we turn the case. It's like, even if you win that the only reason war occurs is because of poverty, you probably don't turn, quote-unquote, whatever specific impact the DA is. It's like, maybe in a long time from now, there'll be a conflict similar to the DA.
It's a PMN.
I don't think anybody knows what that means.
This is 2010.
Maggie is referring to Plan Meets Need, a sovereignty argument utilized in South Dakota in the 60s that argued that you could, in fact, solve for some things, but not be sufficient to solve for all of the needs required to solve your advantage internally.
But it's true.
It's actually Plan Meets Need is about the harm. Plan Meets Advantage, or the PMA, is about the advantage.
I always got those two confused, yeah. But, I mean, it's just like... I mean, if someone says time frame, it's just there's no There's no chance you're winning warming turns, whatever it is.
Wasn't there some debate, Scott, when you were in college that you basically dropped a warming advantage against Berkeley, and then you got to the advantage with like 5 seconds, and you're like, this will happen in 100 years.
Yeah, because like we
that's optimistic.
We just crushed on the oil DA, and it's like the oil DA is like global nuclear war a month from now, and they just kind of pushed on like warming turns the oil DA.
But try or die, Scott, we control terminal impact uniqueness. There's only a risk.
I guess the flip side is also kind of ludicrous. Like, there was a couple of judges who judged Emory at Georgia State when I listened to their decision. They were just kind of like, live to fight another day, which I think is like the flip side of try or die extremism, which is like, they kind of said basically that we won an extinction impact that was like 20 years away, and the AF won kind of a short term, like, you know, really bad thing. So however many people die, hundreds of millions or a billion or whatever. And they were like, well, we'll just risk extinction because of short-term hundreds of millions. And that kind of strikes me as equally absurd. If you have extinction 20 years from now versus, like, war in Asia now, you know, war in Asia bad, extinction worse.
Yes.
And so that's where you kind of need to do the flip side and say time frame's not everything, you know. It could rain 1 minute from now. That doesn't make rain worse than prolif.
Do you think that's all the debaters, though? I really think there are just sometimes judges just have some convoluted ways in which they look.
It's so much
do you think
easier.
It's like they look at the result of the DA first and then like use the impact to justify it? Because sometimes you hear people talk about like the way in which they assess the risk of the DA and the impact, and you're like, how did you get there?
I think a lot of judges, they think they're doing magnitude times probability. But what they're really doing is, like, magnitude times a million times probability.
These people did not do well in math.
Yeah,
that's why they became debaters. And now magnitude times probability calculations are somewhat difficult.
I mean, debaters definitely don't do their work on this to make it any clearer for the judges to why they should win. It's always like, extinction, you know, try or die, blah, blah, blah. But sometimes you, like, listen and you're like, maybe you can convince this, you know, maybe you are with stupid, you know. It's just, I don't know what to do.
Well, it's like that statistical fallacy where it's like consecutive probabilities. They think like two-thirds of uniqueness and two-thirds of length equals four-thirds of the disadvantage.
Or even two-thirds of the disadvantage.
Yeah, when it's actually much less than that.
I gave a lecture at the SDI about that, and people's minds were just blown. That if you win 10% of your link, the maximum risk of your DA you can win is 10%.
Well, yeah, that's another diatribe I don't want to get
they
into.
They still don't understand that.
But if the DA turns the case, you also...
Then, apparently,
you don't need to win very much of it.
Like 100%, yeah.
As long as it has a propensity to turn it, that's fine.
Yeah, I also think war turns the case arguments, like were there to be a war that would spread
that would
disease,
be bad. Yeah.
Are just totally useless. And anytime I see someone who's like, oh, it's closed the case to DA, but war causes
war.
Disease, it's like, if you've won war... And you need something else.
And you didn't really win war.
No.
Yeah, I find myself constantly confused about how much people assign, like how much risk they assign to stuff. And I find myself assigning an equally smaller amount to everything, but still thinking that it's important. And other people just seem to not think that anything is important unless it kills everyone, which is baffling as a starting point.
Yeah, I hate to toot someone else's horn, but you should listen to Bill's lecture on, is it on the, can we get it through the camp lecture series?
Yeah, it's on the camp post.
The camp post, it was at Georgetown that you gave the lecture, right? Uh-huh. Listen to that lecture about risk. I had the kids in my lab listen to that lecture. Like, you might need to flow the lecture, because there's, like, complicated stuff, you know, more than your skills can handle currently. Write some stuff down, take some notes, it'll help you... really understand debating risk a lot better than the way in which you currently do it, which is extinction happens faster or extinction happens eventually.
Happens eventually.
Because that's basically the way in which you're debating impacts now.
So we've talked about flowing. The other thing that's kind of become an issue is what are the norms with regard to paperless and sort of what counts as prep time. And in particular... how should debaters approach their judges, or should they approach their judges, to ask about paperless norms? There are some people, just in reading philosophies and in talking to people, that have very different interpretations of what counts as prep time and sort of what is to be expected in a paperless debate. From the one extreme where everything is prep time, and in fact you probably get prep time auto-taken away because you're paperless, to the people that are like, paperless teams can take 6 hours and it's fine because I'm not going to enforce anything. Roy, what about, you're kind of, you used to be classified as an anti-paperless guy. I'm not sure.
I think Luddite is the term.
Neo-Luddite.
No Neo.
Not really Neo at all either.
I mean, for the, yeah, I mean, we did transition to paperless, and I'll say this, it happened for two reasons. One, the kids wanted to do it, and two, you actually understand how to do paperless. To say that I am a fan of, I mean, I'm tolerant of it, and it made checking in at the airport a lot easier, which were things that were on my side nice, but I don't know. I'm still not sure how good we are at it.
We're apparently terrible. We watched our practice debate.
Yeah, after the practice debate we saw yesterday. But apparently,
so apologies to every judge that has judged Woodward, because apparently we don't know how to do paperless. But we're working on it.
I think, and I got this from, this is not mine, I'll give credit where credit is due, to Josh Clark and some people at the Michigan debate camp, and I think this is the standard that I'm upholding, is that prep time ends for the team when the speech is saved onto the jump drive and is ready to be jumped to the other team. Now, since most teams have gone paperless, and I think all the debates I judged were either paperless, or quasi-paperless, this is pretty fair to everyone. That means that you do not say, I'm ready, oh, I need to save it on a jump drive. It is, once it is on the jump drive and saved, it is ready. If you are slow at saving it on a jump drive, that will hurt you. But both teams have it the same way because both teams are paperless and have to do that. I think that's fair. Then it minimizes the amount of time in which it takes to jump over. And then this, if it didn't save onto the jump drive, prep starts again until it's saved onto the jump drive. You don't have a jump drive, you shouldn't be doing paperless. Get a jump drive. If you don't have the appropriate things, you didn't bring paper, then you shouldn't do paper evidence. You can't
take some prep time. I gotta go buy some paper and print out.
I'm gonna go buy a ream of paper from someone while this debate's going on. No. You save the speech onto the jump drive, you give it to them, it minimizes time. Is it gonna cost time? You know, is it probably, people are like, it's still faster than paper. I'm not sure that it's still faster than paper, but I think that's the fairest way for both people, both teams, etc. And for the most part, I think people who debate in front of me know my general non-affinity towards paperless, so they try to be on top of it a little bit more, but it really all depends on how much of a curmudgeon I am at that point. If I'm in a real grumpy mood, I'll probably be more angry about it. If I'm in a, you know, jolly good old time mood, then it won't bother me as much. But I think that save it up to the jump drive, then you're done. Give it to the other team. It's the most fair. It's consistent, reciprocal, everything. Try your best.
I'll say, we agree, but when we told our kids this, they were like, that's terrible. No one else believes that. So, kind of curious.
Well, other people are terrible, so that's not our fault.
No, I really do think that that's sort of the emerging norm. We're not there yet, but I do think that sort of it gives an incentive to the paperless team to save things efficiently. It decreases the anxiety of a paper team that thinks that they're secretly still prepping over there while they're saving. I don't really know how much that happens, but it's definitely a very high fear. And so solving that problem is at least, one thing along the way to easing any transition that happens. It means that on the other side, a team that is slow to put the jump drive in, open the jump drive, etc., that doesn't come off the paperless team's prep time, which seems like the alternative to swing too far in the other direction. This seems like a pretty reasonable interim step.
I just don't understand people who, if you don't put any kind of restriction or any kind of like thing on that, then the kids will take for goddamn ever. They will be so slow. Like, if you don't make it like prep time doesn't stop, they'll just take as their sweet ass time doing whatever they want to do and getting their stuff ready. And it's, you know, it's like people who don't monitor prep time. I'm going to go to the bathroom and I'm going to go do this. I'm going to go wash my, No. It's ready to go. I wanted to do rolling prep, but people have said that rolling prep is too old school. For those of you all who don't know what rolling prep is that if you're not talking...
It's Wheatley.
Yeah. If you're not talking, you're prepping. So if you want me to do rolling prep, if you don't want me to do rolling prep, get good at this, or don't prep me, which either or is fine with me. But if you do prep me, make sure that this is the way in which you do it, because the kids don't whop, carrots don't help the kids, the stick. It's punishments, not carrots. Scott?
Okay, I have, like, a couple of things. So I'll try and keep this, like, somehow coherent. First, If it takes you more than 10 seconds to save something to a jump drive, you're a mongoloid. Like, I don't understand. I judged the debate. I really want to name names, but I won't.
Name names.
It took, like, 8 to 10 minutes to get the jump. Like, oh, this jump drive doesn't... Oh, this jump drive doesn't agree with my computer. I need the other jump drive. It's like, Control-Shift-S. That's all it is.
How do you do paperless and not know how to use a jump drive? You presumably have to do it.
No, how do you breathe?
Yeah, oxygen, how are you alive in the 21st
century? Or not know how to use... I mean, yeah. So that is, first of all, just like, I have no...
Name the name.
I
could burn a speech to a CD drive and give it to the other team before some of these teams can do the flash drive. It's horrible.
Second, 10 minutes of prep time is way too much goddamn prep time. Like, when I debated, I didn't think 10 minutes was enough, but it's not because I was prepping. It's because I could never find anything that I needed because I never spent any time filing or, like, organizing the tubs. So... You know, of that 10 minutes, 9 minutes and 58 seconds was spent like, oh, where did I put the 1NC to this?
Where's those updates?
Oh my god, oh, I need the meat card. Where's the meat card? Okay, but you have a computer and none of that's relevant. So, like, I see all these debates where each team has, like, 9 minutes of prep left for their final rebuttal, which, first of all, you shouldn't because you should have prepped at some other point. But 10 minutes is way too much. So if you're really concerned that Roy's, you know, gypping you out of 20 seconds of prep time because you had to save it to the jump drive, you've got enough prep
time. I'm a gypsy, so please don't use...
I was going to say something else similar. But,
I'm a gypsy Jew as well.
So those are kind of like my initial two reactions. But third, I've judged a couple of teams, I think, maybe like Damien, and I think in college Northwestern does this too, but like if they're debating paperless... They, like, print the speech out. So is that their prep time then, whatever time it takes to prep to print the speech?
So when they get the jump drive.
Yeah, I judge Northwestern.
Yeah, they don't want to read it off the computer. So when you jump something to them,
they
print it
on their computer, and they print it, and then they just use the paper copy, and they, like, write all over it and stuff.
I'm fine with that.
I didn't know.
They get to do that for free time?
No. Once the 1NC starts, you don't need to see the A-spec shell. The first off case is always some horrible procedural they're never going for.
Oh, so you're saying they should print it during the speech?
Yeah, as the speech goes on.
That annoys the crap out of me.
Not only move the printer.
Berkeley does that. Like, I don't know what Jacob Pollan does, but somehow in every debate, he needs to constantly be printing. He has no files printed out before the other team starts speaking for some reason. And I don't know, maybe I did judge him against a couple of low talkers, but like...
Is it laser? Is it laser?
Yeah, it's like the brother laser printer. It's like the loudest printer humanly conceivable. Dot matrix, I think, would have been quieter than this thing. But yeah, that kind of bothers me, I think.
I mean, it depends on how close you're sitting, but I think that... I don't think it's crazy to say that you should print it as it starts. You get it jumped to you. You have two options. You can either read it off the computer as it goes along, or if you want to print it... I'm not waiting for you because you decided that you want to get fancy-schmancy and start printing stuff. I've got things to do today. So no.
Yeah, well, see, like, I think that's, like, one of the things you said, like, prep ends when you hand them the jump drive. Like, yeah. It's their job to open it up on the computer or whatever.
Well, no, prep, yeah. Well, their prep ends when you hand them it. But there's obviously going to be some, like, 20 seconds of dead time as they upload it. But even then, they could start reading.
You're not during the 1NC.
Yeah, I don't know why you need it before the speech.
Well, because the only reason is because sometimes these jokers can't save it to the jump drive, and then it's not there, and then you get a disaster. There's got to be verification that it's on the jump drive.
That was actually an intelligent comment.
Thank you.
I'm kind of shocked.
Because if not, then they don't have it, and then you're going to stop Jamie Carroll-esque 1NC. Give him the laptop. Give him the laptop. You know, just for inside joke. But, you know, just like stuff like that. So you got to wait 20 seconds there. I'm okay with that 20 seconds of time. But if you want to do other things like start printing it or get a scribe to start writing it out for you, you need, that's your own time. And you can use 20 seconds of prep time before the speech starts in order to print that out, but that's your option. But I think the bigger picture that losing sight of this was Maggie said that kids are having issues with how they express it with the judges, right? Or how do that? So what was the question?
I guess I think that...
Because I'll answer it when you answer.
Okay. That there are a lot of things in the debate community that coaches can pretty firmly give advice to their kids on sort of this is how we do things. Whereas paperless, there are lots of different perspectives on it right now. And some people have put it in their adjusting philosophy, which is great. Some people have not really, which means that there's a whole segment of people that you may not know how they feel about these issues until the debaters show up at the debate. And I guess, so I wanted to sort of discuss how debaters can both start to suss that out and do so in a way that's both polite and effective. Gets them the info they need to know without them being grumpy jerks.
The solution is ask the judge. If someone was like, how do you evaluate prep time, then I would probably go into a 20-minute tirade that would take longer than the paperless issues we have.
I kind of think that's the problem.
That's what she's trying to avoid.
That's what I'm trying to avoid. I want to know what you think without having to listen to your tirade.
Well, then...
I think the key is to... I've had some people ask me about this, and it always seems like they're whining preemptively about how they need more time and how they're so worried about how much time they're going to have. I think if they just default to the... We're going to, we'll use our prep time until our flash drive is ready to hand over.
Yeah, let's create a norm.
Is that okay? That I would be like, yes, that's fantastic. Good. But the debaters were like, what happens if my computer crashes? It's like, if you're really planning on your computer crashing in the middle of the debate, that's probably not good.
I would also say that anyone that asks me if their computer is going to crash before the debate, I'm much less likely to be nice, because
like,
it clearly means that
you
they
knew that your computer
was going
to crash. It's horrible.
Whereas the child
what if they're
shocked.
Just like a poor kid who has a crappy computer?
Then don't do paperless.
No, but Roy, don't be grumpy.
I think I will always...
If I don't have a laptop, then I can't do paperless. If my laptop is horrible, it does not help me win. If I need to bring less files... There are 6 apps on this topic. No one is... I have not seen a card on Kuwait. You're going to read something horrible, probably. Just, you're going to read a K.
Doesn't
you're going to read a...
include Kuwait?
Whatever. The point is that... It's going to be, you don't need that much stuff with you. If you've got a laptop that really sucks, then don't do it. Then don't do paperless. If I've got a bad printer, I'm not going to print stuff out because I can't print. Or if I don't have a printer, I won't print. So if your computer is really bad and you know it's really bad, then look for other ways.
I was going to say, other than Roy the angry man, I think most people are relatively reasonable. And if your computer actually does crash unexpectedly in the middle of the debate... There are very few judges that are going to just be like, nope, timer's running. Sorry. Sucks to be you.
It's never the kid with the crappy computer that asks. It's the kid with
the
24-inch
yeah.
brand new MacBook who's like...
You know what never crashes?
Yeah, that's true. Your computer wouldn't crash as much if you weren't, like, pirating Call of Duty and like, getting viruses and stuff.
Paper never crashes.
Profound.
I mean, it's just... are you serious? If the thing, if the guys or the girls like computer crashes like halfway through the choice, what do you do?
Depends. Theoretically, they should just get it on their partner's computer.
The partner has it up. The reading computer has it up.
Okay, the partner.
You're telling me all three
grab a different laptop.
Flash?
If there's like an EMP attack, then I'm just canceling the debate.
Okay, let's say the partner didn't have. I mean, let's say the partner did. In the interim, they're like, my computer crashed. The other partner's obviously not flowing. They're doing something else. So they are not sure, they're not listening to what's going on in the 2AC. If she does she has to run over to the laptop and she just the timer's running and she keeps going, or do you stop the speech, let her go get the partner's laptop and then continue?
The first one
should
I
take
guess,
like
but
10 seconds.
Like 4 seconds. I mean I think that's the same way as like, oh crap, I forgot to bring up this impact. Can you hand it to me and then the partner's
going pocket 12 of that accordion.
Now can they take the viewing laptop that they gave the other team if their laptop crashes? If their partner, let's say they've got 2 laptops as a team, right? I've got one that I'm reading off of, and then the second one is the viewing laptop. Let's say you don't have 3. What happens then?
Just make it through the speech.
I mean, I guess it's similar.
Oh no,
to like,
this is an issue we need to resolve, people.
Like paper teams with a like podium collapses.
That's a good question.
And their stuff like goes everywhere.
Perhaps timer's running.
Yeah, I don't think you get to hit pause. It's like you should have constructed a better podium.
Yeah, but in this instance, the only other place where this speech is at is at the opponent, the laptop that you gave the opponent. Do you get to now take that laptop?
Yeah, I don't think the opponents have the right to see the evidence until your speech is done. I really am unconcerned. That you can't read it.
Yeah, the idea
is this going to go into my next rant?
Yeah, this will go into your next rant.
We have to listen to another one of these?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's been a while, so go ahead.
Well, set it up, Bill. I need a setup. Well,
I mean,
be my setup guy.
You want to start with this?
No.
You want to start with the other
one?
Okay. People get really irritated, have been getting really irritated, and there have been a lot of complaints that I've heard people express in person at tournaments and on the internet about how the other team is wronging them in some way by not providing them with exactly what they want in terms of their evidence, their analytical arguments, when they get it, the size that it is, the font that it is. There's just all sorts of complaints and sorrows and terrible sadness.
You are not entitled to analytical arguments on the block. In fact, back in the day, when you saw that two kids weren't paying attention and they were talking to each other, that is when you inserted analytical arguments or theory arguments in order to get them to punish them for mistakes that they made. I explicitly remember at the Dartmouth Round Robin my senior year seeing two debaters talking to each other during my 2EC, in which I decided to drop a perm to the counterplan while they weren't paying attention, and they dropped that perm to the counterplan, and we won the debate on that because they were not paying any attention. So if you think that you're entitled to analytical arguments, you are wrong. You need to flow. You need to write down what they're saying. You need to pay attention 8 minutes at a time, sometimes five, to what they're saying and write those things down. Okay. If you complain that perm do both, assume that they made a perm do both at some point. Even if you don't answer it in the right order, be like perm do both, links to the net benefit. They say perm do the counterplan, it separates. They're going to say those two in the 2AC. You don't need to have it there. You need all the analytical arguments that they've made. Flow. What are you doing that is so important during the speech? And here's the other thing, is that, here's the real rub, is that all these people that are like, we need the evidence, we need to, you know, the obsession with the jumping that Scott said, it's, I almost think that we shouldn't jump evidence to anyone, because I haven't seen people make evidence comparison. You don't get to the evidence until you start making evidence comparison. When I start hearing a debate where three or more of the debaters can actually reference a piece of evidence the other team has read and say why their piece of evidence is better for some reason, then you're entitled to get evidence in the future. But until you do that, you just get the card in order to do that. It's like, before we need prep time, I need all of your cards, or I need to see all of this stuff. What do you do with all that stuff? Because it's not referenced in your speech. Is it for cites for the next debate? What are you doing? Because you're not getting anything that I need. You're not making any argument that I need to hear about that piece of evidence. So unless you're willing to do that, you shouldn't be crazy about jumped arguments, analytical arguments, or anything like that.
The sort of corollary to this is, the thing that people say is that when they listen to their opponents, they can't understand what they're saying, so therefore they need to read the written transcript. The solution is not written transcript. The solution is people need to speak comprehensively so that their opponents can understand them. And it's absurd that people use that as a justification for why they need a full, in order, perfectly annotated transcript of everything their opponent has said. I don't understand why judges are willing to kind of go along with all of this, but if people would just be clear, then their opponents could listen to them, write down what they have said, and then answer their arguments, and we would not have to have these.
I'd be more persuaded that that argument is true, too, if I saw any attempt to flow. Like, not having paper out is a pretty good hint that you're not going
to
make.
No, I've asked debaters after rounds, you know, were you flowing? And they look at me like I just asked them, you know, if they could go get me food or something. I'm like, well, that's an absurd question. Why are you asking me that? I was debating this round, not flowing. But I don't understand.
It used to be a time where people would flow the 1AC even.
Yeah.
Like, they wouldn't even be getting their 1NC out, and you'd be like, no, you need to go get your 1NC out. And they're like, oh, no, we have to flow the 1AC. Now?
Now people expect that the affirmative will just tell them everything they're going to say in the 1AC, word for word, and flash it to them.
We can say that for, that's another weekend worth of. Can you tell me everything, every 2NR
you've ever said?
What have you gone for in every 2NR?
Can I have the full text of every tournament you've ever read?
What has been every single argument? They used to be scouting, used to be intelligence. Now, before the debate, you just need to answer all these questions about everything you've ever gone for in any 2NR, at any tournament, at any given point during the year.
And it's not like this is improving the quality of debates. And the people are never satisfied with the answer. So all it does is create angry pre-round nonsense, not better debates.
Scott?
Yeah, I just wouldn't answer any of those questions. If I had been debating and someone had asked me that, I'd have been like, figure it out.
Yeah. It's a reasonable response.
Especially now there's like the wiki.
I mean, I guess it's okay, like, if you're like, what politics DA have you been reading this tournament? I mean, I'm okay with that question, but what have you gone for in all of your 2NR? Like, I've never asked that question to anyone as a debater, as a coach, and I cannot possibly, I hate it when teams ask us that question. If I know that we're going to beat the team, we'll tell them the answer, and I'll probably tell them what we're going for in this 2NR. But in most instances, it's just a very obnoxious line of questioning. It means, like, you cannot look at a pairing and go ask someone. It should be some minimum.
I don't know. I don't care about that much. I don't think it... I think it the things that we do in the debate community that add to annoying time that could just be answered by someone being nice, it seems like that's wasted time. Like, the time that I spend tracking down somebody who judged you round three is time that I could be coaching. But it's also time that, when you're doing it, you could be coaching. And so it seems like...
Yeah, but the time you're asking me, what advantages do you read? What's the terminal impact card? How much of me do you read? That's like time I could be prepping.
Well, you're right. I mean, it's
the way that people ask. They're just, there's such a sense of
entitlement.
It's an expectation.
Yes.
It's not, you know, I could go find this out, but would you mind, you know, just...
Why don't we just make the wiki, on the wiki now, everyone has to write what they went for in every 2NR also so that it's open.
Well, but the problem is, the teams that do that, the other team still asks them. Because they ask all these annoying questions. It's like, so you said that you went for this politics decision. What was the impact that you went for? What terminal impact card did you read? What was the leak arguments that you said? Blah, 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 blah. And it's just like, people just demand kind of aggressively information from their opponents. And it's just
Woodward Academy will no longer answer those questions. That's just a policy.
Shocker.
We won't ask either.
Yeah, we won't ask though. We don't care.
We'll
do our own intel, and we don't want to know what you... We're not going to answer your questions. If you ask us, we'll refer to this 3NR podcast. You can listen to this whole podcast to find this segment. It'll be
it's like a crutch. It's like when you're not adequately prepared, then you need to find out what things they've gone for in the 2NR so that you can put a 2AC block together to that. But you should have a 2AC block to the deterrence disad before you get on the plane.
The other difference is that they ask you what politics DA you've been reading. Let's assume, for instance, that you have not heard of this said politics DA. What are the odds that you're going to find all the answers you need in the next 5 minutes before this debate starts? It's like, start. Shit. Crap. We're not prepared for start.
We
got to
get our start stuff right.
Yeah, we got, crap, we forgot. We didn't hear about start. What are we going to do? You know, it's like, how much work are you going to get done in the next 10 minutes on this? If you didn't have start answers before the tournament, or if you didn't have answers to, like, XDA before the tournament, you're probably not going to get them in the next 10 minutes.
And
your reaction to that will probably tell us that you don't have answers to that DA, and which will make us more likely for us to read that DA instead.
Yeah, I mean, at this last local tournament, our kids asked the other team that, and it doesn't affect, whatever their answer was, it's not going to affect any of our preparation. If we didn't have an answer to an argument, it's not going to change because now we know that they went for
something.
They
can pull their three start you non-unique
cards. I don't understand why people need that for their pre-round affirmative prep. And I'm not sure what they use it for. I mean, it's helpful, obviously, if it's a team you don't know anything about. Are they more of a K team or are they more of a policy team? But beyond that, I don't think you really need... You don't need the blow-by-blow about, you know, you read Afghanistan, what did they go for against Korea in round two?
But there's only, like, three affirmatives. That information on this topic is much more useful than it has been in the past. It's not like social services where it's like you read healthcare and they asked a question about, like, I don't know, DOMA, that's obviously not very useful. But when there's, you know, effectively three affirmatives, knowing what the strategy that they've gone for against Afghanistan, the other three Afghanistan debates that they've had this tournament is
go get some intel.
Well, but I mean, I still don't know what, like, let's say that you know that they went for the deterrence to set three times. What do you do differently?
I mean,
you still got to answer everything in the 1NC.
Sure, you still have to answer everything in the 1NC, but probably the pre-round coaching time you spend talking about the 2AR versus deterrence as opposed to the 2AR versus the start DA.
You don't know what your 2AR versus deterrence is before the double octo finals of whatever upcoming tournament you're at, then you should. It's amazing you made it to the double octo finals. There's nothing that could... There's literally nothing that can help you in that instance that will help you significantly. If you read Afghanistan, you're right, everyone reads the same crappy Afghanistan strategies, which means that if you're not ready for that crappy Afghan strategy, you're in trouble. You're not going to win. And there's probably a reason they flip negative. Because they know you're not ready.
I just think kids freak out way too much about it.
No, that's the freak out factor is definitely true. The things that we do that increase the amount of time we spend running from room to room
I don't
seems totally
that.
Useless.
It's good for cardio.
Well, I just want to minimize before debate any interaction that I have to have with the other team and or the bigger problem, their coaches.
Their coaches, yeah.
And so... You get like
sometimes
30
coaches
seconds.
Are pleasant like me.
What's the plan? What advantages do you read? That's it. You should have no interaction with the other team after that.
Yeah.
None. And their coach is less than that.
Yeah. That's how it used to be. It's like an arms race.
I guess we need proper flip etiquette? Should we discuss that? Do we need that?
I mean, that's another
didn't we already
thing.
Do? You're like obsessed with this. I think we've done this on like five other podcasts.
We did it once.
We always talk about conditionality. It seems like proper flip out.
It's so bad.
Anyhow, the other topic that I wanted to ask you guys about, Bill and I talked about this for a while, and Scott, you referenced this a little bit earlier, is like the amount of prep time and the amount of prep time saved. In a lot of the debates that I watched, the 2AC and the 2NC were giving almost stand-up speeches. So maybe they use a minute of prep in the 2AC, and then the 1AR would use like another minute, and then the 2AR would have 7 minutes of prep or 8 minutes of prep, and then the 2NR would take no prep. The 2NC would take no prep, and it would have around 10 minutes of 10 minutes of prep basically for the 2NR. And it seems as if these debaters, I mean, I don't know what you need 10 minutes of prep for the last speech for. With 10 minutes of prep, you can prep for 5 minutes, give the speech once, and come back in. And then give the speech again. That's way too much prep time. And I think that, especially the 2AC, these 2ACs are standing up and giving stand-up 2ACs. It's like, if you bone it in the 2AC, it's over. Like, a good 1AR might get you back in the game, but I think that if you're going to get 10 minutes of prep, which I almost never afford people, I think it's always should be 8. But let's assume that the tournament gives you 10, which I don't think is, necessary. You got 10 minutes. Use 3 minutes for the 2AC. 7. You got 7 left. Use 3 minutes for the 1AR, 2.5 minutes. Gives yourself 4.5 minutes. 4.5 minutes for the 2AR, more than enough.
That's good.
If you can't get it done in the 2AR with 6 minutes, 7 minutes isn't going to help you. And 8 minutes definitely won't do anything for you. Right? It's like, at some point, it's just, you need to have some time left there, but 10 minutes for the last speech, not good.
Yeah, unless you've gotten, like, top speaker in an Octo's Bid tournament, you should be using at least 2 minutes of prep for any speech that you have to give, I feel.
Yeah,
like.
I mean, I don't think there's no situation where I've seen a 2AC just stand up, give their speech, where I've been like, oh, well, that was fantastic. There was a lot of specific comparison, you really thought about this, you've spent time in places for strategic reasons. That never happens. They're just like, okay, I had it blocked everything, so I'm ready, and I'm going to stand up and be like, no prep.
And Bill, you said that you saw that in college, too. It's
I
like,
did see that.
It gives a visceral reaction if the 2AC is not good. Because if the 2AC stands up and is like, cross six is over, like, the 2AC is like, ready.
Ready, here's my order.
Here's my order. And then they stink, you're like, during that whole 2AC, you're like, you should have been used prep.
You should have used prep.
Here's a place you could use it. Here's another place you could use it. Here's another place you could use it.
It's like, think through the stuff. Like, don't just auto pull out the blocks. And then the 2NC too, it's like, I mean, I was a 2NC, when I was the 2N, I was horrible at it, but I used a ton of prep time. I don't get these people who basically give, like, stand-up 2NCs. Probably because they're not flowing, but...
Yeah, I mean, if you don't flow, not a lot of pressure. You don't have to answer anything. You just read your stuff.
Do you think, 5 minutes for the last speech, is that good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you all I know in Minnesota grew up doing this, but in Wisconsin we all had 5 minutes, and our local tournament still had 5 minutes. And debaters are fine. I mean, I think that extra 3 minutes sometimes, especially in top-level debates where there's more evidence read, is helpful, but you can survive with 5 minutes. You don't need 5 minutes for your last speech.
Yeah, for like most of the practice debates in our lab this summer, we gave them 5 minutes of prep and banned jumping the speeches.
Yeah.
And the debates were substantially better.
Yeah,
and
I mean,
there was no restrictions.
And faster. At the end of the debate, there are probably a few cards that the other team read that you could read and kind of make an argument and it would be important for the decision. And you just you need to learn what you need to read and where you need to invest that time making those comparisons. But the way people do things now, they just get everything. They try and read everything. They don't pay any attention to what the other team is saying. And they end up not learning that skill, which I think you are forced to learn when you only have 5 minutes of prep time or where you're in a circuit where you don't have access to the other team's evidence. Like in Kansas or Missouri, a lot of those kids grow up going to tournaments where you can't see the other team's evidence. It's just like not allowed. And those people end up being kind of better at evidence comparison stuff because they got to listen and they got to think about it. I think we're losing that.
I think I might install a speaker point penalty now. If your speech is not, if you give a stand-up speech, and it's not, there's some like noticeable gaping holes in that speech, then I might dock you half a point for not using prep time. Thoughts?
Aren't you just docking them points from their speech being bad already?
Yeah,
it might be additional.
Like double jeopardy.
I feel like the speech being bad sort of solved that.
At least it'll be something.
You know what it can do is it can just like offset the it moots their ability to get the flowing benefit. So if you flow but you still don't take any prep time, then you don't get the flowing benefit. The other thing, we've talked about this before, I don't know if this is true, I've talked to some other people about this, and some people agree, most people seem to not agree, but I think when there's excessive amounts of prep time for one of the last two speeches, the other team's arcs just kind of sink in more, and you kind of lose the flow of the debate, and it just feels really strange. Like, when there's, I judged a debate where the two-air had 10 minutes of prep, and by the time the two-air started talking, I was like, I had almost forgotten what the debate was about, and it just didn't feel right. And I think even if the two-air is good, you're just sort of losing a little bit of the, like, back-and-forth rejoinder. It's the reason that, like, good cross-sexes are entertaining is, like, you get sort of, there's some more clash. But I just don't understand why people would want to have 10 minutes to let the other team's arg sink in and for the judge to just kind of internalize them and then start speaking their stuff. Does that make any sense?
So, I mean, like, you're, I mean, like, one of those, like, feel people, so...
I have emotions, I guess, sense, yeah.
I mean, I usually... to me, it might actually even be the opposite, because 10 minutes is so long ago that I might forget what the 2NR was about. So that might be one of the... Maybe that's their tool, because I just...
Get you to forget about it?
Well, I mean, I probably wasn't really listening that much anyway, but whatever I did pay attention to, I've now forgotten. But what do you think about this? I remember that Jonah Feldman told me this once, and this is back to the prep time thing a little bit, but that... The only instance in which that would be okay is that if you saved all that prep time is if you actually go outside and practice the 2AR ones. Would that be cool?
Yeah, I've heard stories about that. Have you,
I've never seen that happen. Scott, have you seen that? You've been debating for a while.
No, why would you ever do that?
Just like, just get, you know, do it in front of your partner once. Just get, you know, give it a little practice run through.
No. Stupid.
I guess it's like redos. I hated redos too. But it's like a pre-do.
It's like the
it's a pre-do, not a redo.
Yeah. I've heard stories about the people who would have their partner loudly practice the 1NC during the 1AC. That's like an old CETA thing, I think.
That's a little strange. But the pre-do, I think we should... That's a cool term.
Pre-do. That probably wraps it up for tonight.
Yeah. We don't have a timer on you. How long
we don't have a timer on you. This has been extremely long.
No, it hasn't been that bad.
It's not going to set a new record. Mm-hmm. We would welcome some feedback. Roy said, you know, throughout the gauntlet, if you don't flow or if you don't think kids should flow, make your arguments. We'll flow them and then respond to them. But otherwise, we're going to try and get back into a regular schedule of doing this.
If you've got stuff you want us to talk about, too, post in this thread.
In this thread about what you want. Good. But now that we're all in Atlanta, we're going to do it live.
We'll do it live! And,
hopefully continue to bring on some new voices. So thanks to Maggie for joining us for the first time. And for
first time, last time.
It's up to our listeners, and I think they're going to probably vote her on the island. If anybody's getting voted off the island, I think I know who it is.
It's tough since we're recording it in our apartment.
In our apartment.
But I could go to my room.
True. for Scott Phillips and Roy Lefkowitz, I'm Bill Batterman. Thank you for listening to the 3NR Podcast.
Yeah. Welcome to Atlanta, jacking hammers and bows. Back to the mackin' and jacking the clothes. Adolescents packing a fold.
A knock on the door.
Who is it?
I would happen to know the one with the flow.
Who did it?
It was me, I suppose.
JD in the rolls and looters in the cut supreme. Skating down old Nat, Gat tucked and lean.
I split your spleen. As a matter of fact, I split your team. No blood on the sneaks. Gotta keep it so my...